Good morning, I'm Beth, and I'll be reading you today's edition of the Cape Cod Times, dated Monday, April 29th. We start with weather in the lottery, and today is looking gorgeous, a high near 60 degrees, sometimes of clouds and sun, but overall one of the nicer days we've had. Tuesday, back down in temps to a high of 53, and it's cooler, obviously, with more clouds than sun. And Wednesday, even lower, it's a high of 51 with a couple of showers in the morning. Back to Thursday, though, it's warming up, again with times of clouds and sun, high near 58. Taking a look from the lottery this weekend, Sunday's numbers game, the midday drawing from yesterday, the numbers were 1804. And last night's Sunday night drawing was 7238. Mass cash for Sunday, April 28th, 13, 15, 19, 25, 33. And Saturday's Powerball numbers, 9, 30, 53, 55, 62. Powerball was 23. First front page headline, demolish former Kituit school for 1.1 mil. Some in the village say no. Keep it for now or tear it down. Those are the two options for the future of the former Kituit Elementary School that village residents will consider at a special meeting of the Kituit Fire District on Saturday, May 4th. The meeting is at 1 p.m. in the community room at the Kituit Federated Church at 40 School Street in Kituit. There are two items on the meeting warrant. One, recommended by the Fire District Prudential Committee, would allocate $1.1 million to demolish the 69-year-old school building at 140 Old Oyster Road. The other, proposed by a citizen petition and not recommended by the committee, calls for using previously approved funds to study the feasibility and estimate the cost of rehabilitating all or part of the building. The school, built in 1955, was closed as a local elementary school in 2009. The private Waldorf School of Cape Cod used the space until 2019 before moving to Sandwich. The building was then declared surplus and has been vacant ever since. Last year, the property was transferred from the town of Barnstable to the Kituit Fire District. Prudential Committee Chairwoman Frances Park said the property's condition makes rehab financially untenable in the opinion of the committee members. The building needs about $4 million to make it habitable, Park said. We're not interested in having the voters of the village of Kituit support that. According to the committee, the building has extensive water damage from roof leaks, and there are ceiling tiles and moldy insulation coming down onto the floors. Further, she said, the interior of the building was recently severely damaged by vandals whose identities remain unknown. Windows were broken. They destroyed the emergency lighting. They took a sledgehammer and destroyed toilets and sinks. And they found a box of fluorescent replacement bulbs, and they're broken all over the building, she said. While the future of the building remains undecided, the district has increased monitoring with the addition of heat sensors and motion detectors, so if anybody comes in a window, it's going to set an alarm off, Park said. She said the district already has about $600,000 of the estimated demolition cost available and would need to raise funds or borrow them to cover any remaining cost. Should voters go with the option to demolish the building, Park said the plan would be to keep the site as open space. Since it's just about 400 or 500 feet from one of the village's water wells, she said, this would be to further protect that well. A group of villagers who have formed the Kituit Community Center nonprofit are hoping there is still a chance to save all or part of the building to provide the village with a much-needed place for community activities and gatherings. Their proposal asks voters to proceed with a study of possible future uses and options, including demolition. What the citizen petition is asking for is time, said John Havel, a member of the organization's board. At the 2021 annual district meeting, he said, voters approved transferring $207,500 to reopen and fund a district space needs project to include the school. This did not happen, and since then, villagers have been granted extremely limited access to the building itself for observation or volunteer maintenance due to safety concerns, making educated discussion difficult, Havel said. The Citizens Group estimates the maintenance cost of the building is around $15,000 per year, or roughly $6 per year for each of the 2,500 taxpayers in Kituit, according to Havel, which he said is a small price compared to the estimated $1.1 million cost of tearing it down, so why the rush? The town last November gave a different estimate of $35,000 per year for simply maintaining the property. This isn't about demolition versus some pie-in-the-sky dream of a community center with farmers market and indoor basketball court, Havel said. This is a vote about reiterating the will of the majority of fire district voters from the 2021 Article 17. The ultimate goal of the Citizens Group is to create a community center of sorts which can provide programming and services based on villagers' desires and needs, Havel said, but maybe we just keep the extremely popular and beautifully built gym, leave it as is for a few years to see if anything changes, or use it for something entirely different. In the end, it comes down to whatever people want, and if that's to tear it down, so be it, he said. We just want to slow down and think about it before committing to replacing the school with a field. Second front page story, this headline, Out in a Splash. Cape Cod right whale expert Stormy Mayo retires to dahlias and sailing. One of Charles Stormy Mayo's most vivid memories as a 10-year-old growing up in Provincetown was the first time he saw a humpback whale propel itself out of the water and come splashing down. It's still a snapshot in my brain of the whale in the air with its flippers out, he said, recalling the day, watching with his dad from their boat's flying bridge just south of Wood End Light. Little did he know that Cape Cod Bay's whales would one day inspire him to co-found the Center for Coastal Studies, today a respected multidisciplinary scientific institution, nor that he'd become not only a leading expert in North Atlantic right whale ecology, but also in whale disentanglement methods. Now, 48 years after the center was formed, Mayo, who has long served as the director of its right whale research program, is retiring. For him, it's been all about pursuing a passion for marine science, starting with a deep interest in plankton and larval fish research and expanding to whales. It's been really fun, he said. It never really was a job. Mayo, known by the nickname his dad gave him because he was born during a gale, takes a lot of pride in the center. I tip my hat to the people who came into my orb, all of them bright, genuine, and dedicated, he said. The work and the discoveries are very exciting, but as exciting are the people who dedicated themselves and went on to make very significant contributions to the field. On Wednesday, known as Massachusetts Right Whale Day, Mayo was celebrated by state legislators and the marine science community at the New England Aquarium in Boston. Mayo was presented with a special legislative citation recognizing him for his role in advancing the study and protection of North Atlantic right whales. He also received a commemorative right whale license plate. On May 10th, Mayo's colleagues at the Center for Coastal Studies are planning an evening to celebrate his remarkable career at the Provincetown Town Hall. Looking back, Mayo said the fact that the Center for Coastal Studies even started was all serendipity. It was not a plan. Mayo and his first wife, the late Barbara Schuler Mayo, were hired by the Environmental Protection Agency to evaluate a possible pollution problem off Puerto Rico's northern coast. At the time, he was already thinking about leaving his job as a senior scientist for the Southeast Fisheries Science Center in Miami so he could come home to build a schooner. The money from the EPA project allowed him to do that, he said. The couple moved in next door to Captain Al Avalar, founder of what is now the whale watch company Dolphin Fleet of Provincetown. Avalar was starting a marine bird and whale cruise and offered to pay Mayo to come on cruises to talk about marine life. Though he wanted to stay out of science and get this boat built, he agreed to become the fleet's first naturalist. It was through that experience, he said, we discovered there were lots of whales, and it opened up an opportunity to undertake research he couldn't resist. Another lucky thing was meeting a fellow scientist, Graham Geese, at a public hearing in Provincetown. Mayo, his wife, and I'm sorry if it's Geese, found they shared a passion for marine science, and that became the foundation for the center. In 1984, David Matilla, who was now involved with the center's Marine Animal Entanglement Response Program, began collaborating with Mayo on the whale disentanglement work, for which they are now well known. Although entanglement wasn't as big of an issue as it is now, there were some instances of it, and they wanted to help. He and I started to develop methods for cutting whales free of fishing rope, Mayo said. Today, the center is home to a full-on disentanglement program and is associated with an international program that teaches disentanglement methods. Mayo recalls his first successful disentanglement as if it was yesterday, a humpback whale named Ibis. On Thanksgiving Day 1984, he and Matilla, along with a small crew, responded after getting word of a whale wrapped in fishing net. Mayo recognized the animal. A month prior, he'd taken part in efforts to free the whale off Gloucester, but she'd sunk into the depths and didn't reappear. With a second chance to help, the team needed to figure out how to cut Ibis free without again losing her to a dive. Mayo's father, who was captaining the boat, had the answer. Kegging, an old whaling technique of attaching empty kegs to slow whales and keep them from diving. And so it was that method, once used to hunt whales, was put to use to save one. In this case, they employed a dory and used one of those big orange balls that fishermen used, rope and a grapple hook, he said. Ibis had been swimming with the entanglement for so long that the ropes had dug into her skin. The experience of reaching into the wounds to cut rope away and seeing the animal bleed, Mayo said, was really one of the most dramatic things I've ever felt. It was, my God, this is a living, breathing thing. It's not this scary thing. It's not this big, rock-hard body that's difficult to relate to. It's actually alive, and it's bleeding, he said. How odd to reach into the cut of an animal whose tail is spread 8 to 10 feet out across, and see this relationship between two animals just by the fact that it was doing something you or I do that shows our vulnerability, bleeding. Disentanglement was just part of the center's early work. Mayo's first whale research focused on the humpbacks that frequent the bay in the summer. That focus expanded in the mid-80s amid lots of reports of whales in the middle of the winter when the humpback whales weren't supposed to be here. Mayo decided to investigate, and on January 30, 1985, the team documented their first right whale. It was the beginning of a discovery that right whales were here in great numbers, Mayo said, laying the groundwork for the center to become a globally renowned home for right whale research. Since then, Mayo and his team have revealed Cape Cod Bay to be a feeding habitat of critical importance for right whales, he said. Most of the population of the critically endangered species spends time in the bay feeding, socializing, and nursing newborns during the whale's annual migration north for summer. Over the years, the center has steadily expanded into other areas of research and action. Mayo gives credit to the center's executive board and executive directors for guiding its growth into quite an active and multidisciplinary organization. Now it includes programs focusing on marine geology, fisheries, seals and sharks, water quality studies, ghost gear and beach cleanups, and education. Going forward, Mayo predicted the center will be increasingly dealing with the changes that are coming to our system because of climate change. And though he will be peripherally a part of that as he continues to do some things behind the scenes, he's also looking forward to having more time for his other fanaticisms, growing dahlias and maybe more sailing. In some other news, East Ham firefighters responded to a brush fire and a house fire around 2:24 p.m. on Saturday in the area of Locust Road and Colony Way, according to the fire department's Facebook page. A second alarm was called to bring more manpower to the scene due to the two fires. One person, not a firefighter, was taken from the scene with non-life-threatening injuries. A fire official said by phone Sunday that further information was not immediately available. Mutual aid companies assisted from the towns of Orleans, Harwich, Brewster, Chatham, Dennis, Truro, Yarmouth, and Wellfleet, along with East Ham town staff and the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office. And here is this week's photo shoot column written by Steve Heeslip, chief photographer for the Cape Cod Times, titled T.S. Kennedy's Final Departure from Cape Maritime Campus in Buzzards Bay. Many Cape Codders fall in love with their boats, from kayaks to yachts. I set my sights on 540 feet of sleek steel. Built in 1967, she was in middle age by the time we met, back in December 1999. That was when the freighter named Cape Bon arrived at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy to become their training ship. I was smitten. Since then, I have been lucky to roam just about every inch of the freighter turned training ship, from shaft alley to the engine room and cadet berthing to the bridge. In 2008, when reporter Hillary Russ and I headed to sea with the crew and cadets on their training cruise, the ship had been renamed Enterprise. Leaving campus on the traditional coldest day of early January, heading south with a transit through the Panama Canal. Technology made the trip possible. Ship-to-shore internet service allowed us to transmit back photos and a story every day. It was a training cruise for the cadets, but also the media. I learned the proper way to tie a bowline knot and almost perfected the monkey's fist. At night, I would wander up to the top decks and watch upper-class students work on celestial navigation using sextants. Way too much math in that skill set. Transit through the Panama Canal took place at night, which added to the mystique of the voyage. The ship changed names again in 2009 to the Kennedy, in honor of the Kennedy family. In 2010, it went into dry dock at the Brooklyn Navy Yard for upgrades and repairs. It was there I finally got a good look at her great lines. Standing at ground level, looking up at it was quite a sight. Like any long-term relationship, the years pass ever quicker with age, photographing its coming and goings. The school will be getting a new ship now under construction in Philadelphia, arriving later this year. The T.S. Kennedy has been transferred into service at Texas A&M Maritime in Galveston. So it was wearing that school's colors when it steamed off the Cape Cod Canal last week for its last training cruise for MMA. It was a fitting day for departure, cold and damp, the promise of warm days on every cadet's mind. I did a final walk around from the bridge to the stern for old time's sake. Slack tide arrived at 8 a.m. and all but one line had been cast off. But the fog grew too thick for a safe departure. The ship was tied back to the pier. It would be 6 more hours before it left. But deadlines are hard and fast. One last photo of my longtime companion enveloped in fog for old time's sake. Again, that was a column written by Cape Cod Times photographer Steve Heeslip. And this headline, push for access to menstrual products hits legislature. When women and girls don't have access to menstrual products, they just have to bleed and pray that their pants will hold. Many in Massachusetts are forced to use toilet paper as a substitute for period products. I think it's a matter of dignity in allowing menstruators to have the option to not have to free bleed or just giving them that bodily autonomy of how they want to deal with their periods, said Olivia Toscano, the community organizing co-op of the Massachusetts chapter of the National Organization for Women. Advocacy groups in Massachusetts, such as Mass Now, are calling on House lawmakers to pass the I Am Bill to ensure access to free menstrual products without stigma to all women and girls in all public schools, homeless shelters, prisons, and county jails. It's about making sure that these products, which are part of health care, which are part of our life, are available, said Senator Robin Kennedy, a Democrat from Worcester, one of the sponsors of the bill. It's a basic need that all menstruating individuals have, and it's about making sure that those products for that care are available to all individuals to help break down the disparities. The average woman spends about $20 on feminine hygiene products per cycle, adding up to about $18,000 over a lifetime, according to estimates from the National Organization of Women. It costs a lot to buy these products, said Toscano. There are menstruators out there who have to choose between food, rent, and menstrual products. That's not a choice that should have to be made. I think we need to stop looking at it as a luxury. It's a necessity. In October, the Senate passed the IM bill, originally introduced in 2019, but it has not yet been passed in the House. Kate Barker Swindell, Service and Operations Manager of Period, said Massachusetts has done some work, but it could do better. The Alliance for Period Supplies reports that Massachusetts is considering 9 bills related to menstrual access, while New Jersey leads with a total of 24 bills. Representative Natalie Higgins, a Democrat from Leominster, said the bill is critical because menstrual products are essential, but they are too expensive for many, especially those in schools, prisons, and shelters. I think IM bill really focuses on some of the places where institutionally there can be access issues. So starting with our schools, starting with our shelters and jails and prisons makes a lot of sense, she said. Kyler Spicer, the community organizer of MassNow, said the measure is the first in the country to call for providing free menstrual products for all three places, schools, shelters, and jails. Those three places are some of the places that period poverty is shown the most, so they are some of the most vulnerable populations, she said. I've been working with public schools, libraries, and just connecting with either the head of the department to kind of see what is the need, who actually needs these products, and supplying these products, said Magdalene Bargiolo, the Worcester regional organizer of MassNow. When people donate to the needy, they think first of food and clothing, she said. Menstrual products aren't a part of that conversation, she said. Though through years of advocacy, the conversations and the attention around the problem is growing exponentially, but the stigma is still a real thing. I will say that's across all ages, all races, all cultures, all religions. It's universal, she said. As of right now, Bargiolo said she hasn't seen any schools implement the concept of period poverty within their curriculum. They kind of steer away from it, she said. Even when products are provided in some places, the stigma creates an extra barrier for people who need them, said Spicer. They're afraid to ask for a menstrual product, or they're afraid to take a day off work when they're having really bad cramps. Maybe they have a mental disorder and they can't make it to work that day, or whatever it is, she said. The stigma is something that prevents a lot of folks from maybe achieving their goals. In December, Worcester City Manager Eric Batista said he was going to implement the first phase of providing free products within public spaces in the city early this year. Bargiolo said before anything happens, grassroots organizers will provide communities and public spaces with products. There are approximately 100 women and teens in shelters, and since SNAP benefits don't cover feminine products, we've begun a program called Sister to Sister Cycle Connection at our church, said Lisa McWalters, Social Justice Chair of First Unitarian Church of Worcester. This is a very basic need, and legislation should change the qualification of pads from a luxury item to a basic human right to have access to free feminine products as part of the SNAP benefits. This is the third season since the IM bill was first introduced, and it's approaching the last few months of the second year of this legislative session. Spicer said the biggest hurdle is not lack of support, but making the bill a top priority for legislators. This is a bipartisan bill that everyone supports for the most part, but the issue is just making sure that it's the number one priority for enough legislators that it gets passed quickly, she said. We're getting so close to the end of the session that we're not maybe as confident as we were 6 months ago. But we're really proud of how far it's come by this session and proud of the work that has been done by everyone involved, said Spicer. At this point, it's just did our efforts as much of a difference as we wanted to, or will we be trying again next year? It's really hard to know. In this story, and you might have noticed, state gas prices rose for the second consecutive week and reached an average of $3.57 per gallon of regular fuel last Monday. The previous week, it was only $3.38 per gallon. The average fuel price in state has risen about 28 cents since last month. According to the Energy Information Administration, gas prices across the state in the last year have been as low as $3.07 in January and as high as $3.76 in 2023. A year ago, the average gas price in Massachusetts was 3% lower at $3.47 per gallon. Gas stations along Main Street in Bourne ranged from $3.47 to $3.55 per gallon. As usual, prices rose for drivers crossing the Bourne and Sagamore bridges. Mobil on MacArthur Boulevard sold gas for $3.64, the same price as last week after a 25-cent jump last week. Cumberland Farms was $3.59 per gallon, a 6-cent increase from last week. Prices at three stations along a quarter-mile stretch of East-West Dennis Road, which is Route 134, ranged from $3.51 to $3.65 per gallon, increases of up to 8 cents per gallon. Prices at Mobil, Shell, and Cumberland Farms all increased. Prices in Orleans range from $3.59 to $3.79 a gallon. And at the tip of the Cape, Cumberland Farms on Schenck Painter Road in Provincetown raised prices to $3.73 per gallon. The average gas price in the U.S. last week was $3.67, making prices in our state about 2.8% lower than the nation's average. And this story, President Joe Biden asked journalists to consider their role in safeguarding democracy and called for the release of reporters held abroad during his speech at this year's White House Correspondents Association dinner, known for its lighthearted yet cutting humor targeting Washington. But the president didn't miss out on an opportunity to knock his 2024 rival, former President Donald Trump. "There are some who call you the enemy of the people. That's wrong and that's dangerous," Biden said to a crowd of more than 2,000 journalists, lawmakers, celebrities, and others on Saturday. "Reporters have lost their freedom. Journalism is clearly not a crime, not here, not there, not anywhere in the world." The president and first lady traditionally attend the annual event, and it was far from Biden's first. His attendance last year marked the first presidential appearance at the dinner in 6 years after the event's two-year hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic and former President Trump's refusal to attend while he was in office. Biden targeted a slate of comments Trump has made on the campaign trail in recent months, accusing him of making no secret of his attack on our democracy. "He said he wants to be a dictator on day one," Biden told the crowd, referencing remarks Trump repeatedly made about the southern border and drilling efforts. "He promised a bloodbath when he loses again. We have to take this seriously. 8 years ago, we could have written it off as just Trump talk, but no longer." Biden thanked the journalists in the room and told them, like him, they have a role in ensuring democracy endures. He asked them to live up to the seriousness of the current political moment, making specific reference to January 6, 2021. The president also made a wide range of jokes hitting his political rival. At one point in his speech, Biden, 81, appeared to take up the concerns Americans have about his age. "Of course, the 2024 election's in full swing, and yes, age is an issue. I'm a grown man running against a six-year-old," Biden said, referring to Trump, who he called Sleepy Don. Biden also joked about Trump's ongoing hush money trial in New York and his recent Bible sales pitch. "Donald has had a few tough days lately. You might call it stormy weather," he said. "Trump is so desperate, he started reading those Bibles he's selling. Then he got to the first commandment, 'You shall have no other gods before me.' That's when he put it down and said, 'This book isn't for me.'" Saturday Night Live star Colin Jost also poked fun at the Democratic and Republican presumptive nominees' ages. "I would like to point out it's after 10 p.m. and Sleepy Joe is still awake, while Trump has spent the last week falling asleep in court every morning," Joe said. During his monologue, Joe poked fun at Biden's age, his dwindling support from black voters, and also took shots at Trump's ongoing court cases. Ending his remarks on a somber note, Biden raised his glass, toasting to a free press, an informed citizenry, and an America where freedom and democracy endure. The event attracted celebrities, government officials, and members of the media. Proceeds from the dinner will help fund student journalism scholarships. During the event, the White House Correspondents Association also presented several journalist awards for excellence in White House coverage, presidential news coverage, and courage and accountability. So we've reached the halfway point of our broadcast, and at this time I will read today's obituaries. George W. Calori, Jr. of Falmouth and Venice, Florida, passed away suddenly on April 18th. George was born in 1936 and is survived by his wife of 52 years, Patricia Ford Calori. George was the proud father of Catherine Kate Calori of Scituate and George Calori III and his wife of Hingham. George was a loving papa to Seamus and Connor. He was the oldest of five children to the late George and late Mary Dunn Calori Sr. He was a devoted brother to the late James and his late wife Lynn. Maureen and her late husband John, Catherine and her late husband David Martin, and Marika and her husband Russell Cole. George was a graduate of Archbishop Williams High School and New England Institute of Anatomy, which prepared him professionally as a funeral director. Later in life, George enjoyed a second career as a liquor salesman. George enjoyed skiing the slopes of Loon Mountain, where he raised his two children to ski. He loved watching his son G.W. compete in ski races all over New England. He was excited that his grandsons, Seamus and Connor, were now the ones conquering the mountain. His other great joy was watching his children learn to sail on the waters of Cape Cod. One of his most favorite places to be was the Falmouth Yacht Club. When his daughter, Kate, became a Commodore, it was one of the proudest days of George's life. It wasn't a Sunday if George wasn't on the dock of the FYC having a mudslide and watching the boats come in. George was known for his fashion, especially his whale pants. A few friends commented that he looked like he was a model from the preppy handbook. George and Pat loved to travel extensively. Their most favorite trip was to the Holy Land, where they renewed their wedding vows in Cana. Family and friends are welcome to celebrate George's life. If you have a favorite George outfit, please wear it to the wake. Visitation will take place on Friday, May 3rd, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Chapman Funerals and Cremations, 475 Main Street in Falmouth. A funeral mass will take place on Saturday, May 4th at 10 a.m. at St. Anthony's Church, 167 East Falmouth Highway in East Falmouth, and burial will follow at St. Anthony's Cemetery. Kathleen M. Hole, Kathy, age 63, beloved sister of Terry Hole O'Donnell, sister-in-law of Patrick Allen O'Donnell, deceased, and aunt of Kelly Marie O'Donnell and Tracy Alana O'Donnell, passed away unexpectedly this March at her home on the Cape. She was born in Springfield and raised in Chicopee, moving to the Cape in 1983. She was a graduate of the Chicopee High School class of 79 and from the Springfield Technical Community College with an associate's degree in respiratory therapy in 1981. Throughout her career, she practiced as a certified and licensed respiratory therapist at hospitals, rehabs, and long-term care facilities throughout the state. Although partial disability ended her full-time career, Kathy remained positive and committed to the care of others. She worked part-time providing home respiratory care and volunteered many hours as a professional floral arranger, most notably preparing displays for the Cape Cod Glass Museum. When able, she loved line, ballroom, square, and contra dancing, and was an active participant in many dance clubs. A funeral mass will be held on Wednesday, May 8th at St. Matthew the Evangelist Parish at St. Teresa Church, 466 Concord Road in Billerica at 10 a.m., followed by committal at the Fox Hill Cemetery on Andover Road in Billerica. Rupin Baker Jr. passed away peacefully on April 22nd at home in Sandwich at the age of 88. He was born in Newton and grew up in Haverhill and graduated from Haverhill High School. He went on to earn a B.A. from Boston University and to teach school in Haverhill and in northern New Hampshire, where he was on both the ski patrol and volunteer fire department. He left teaching to work as admissions director at Hawthorne College in Antrim, New Hampshire. It was on a trip to Cape Cod Community College recruiting graduates from that two-year school that he heard of an opening in 4C's admissions department. The pull of the nearby ocean and boating drew him to Cape Cod. Roop returned to school to earn a master's degree from Northeastern, and later, deciding he'd like to return to the classroom, he earned a doctorate at Boston University and spent many years as a professor of psychology at Cape Cod Community College. An avid reader, Roop was a frequent library patron. At one time, he was a trustee of Sturgis Library, and in recent years, he regularly visited the libraries in Sandwich and Kituit. In 1998, Roop met Pamela Smith on a blind date. They married in 2000, bought a trawler, and began annual trips motoring Lady Pamela down the East Coast and over to the Bahamas, where they spent their winters exploring the Exuma chain of islands. August was usually spent visiting islands and harbors in Maine. They enjoyed several vacations on other boats in Greece, Italy, Scotland, Ireland, Alaska, Croatia, and Norway. Rupin is survived by his wife of 24 years, Pamela Smith Baker, his son Rupin Baker III and wife Chrissy of Mexico, and daughter Chris Ann Baker of Maine, a brother James Baker and his wife Diana of Newburyport. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, May 18th at First Church Sandwich, 136 Main Street in Sandwich. Back to the news in this story from West Palm Beach, Florida. Potential Donald Trump vice presidential running mate Kristi Noem is under sharp criticism for reportedly recounting in a book how she killed a family dog. The South Dakota governor has written a book, No Going Back, The Truth on What's Wrong with Politics and How We Move America Forward, which comes out in May. The Guardian has published excerpts from the book in which Noem claims she shot the canine Cricket after concluding the dog was untrainable, dangerous to anyone she came in contact with, and less than worthless as a hunting dog. I hated that dog, Noem writes, according to another quote offered by The Guardian, a UK-based publication with offices in New York City and Washington, D.C. The Guardian also cited Noem complaining that the dog behaved like a trained assassin and described how the governor eventually put the dog in a gravel pit and shot her after the dog attacked a local family's chickens. It was not a pleasant job, the Guardian quoted Noem as writing in the book, but it had to be done. And after it was over, I realized another unpleasant job needed to be done. The reports drew a rebuke from animal rights groups. Wayne Pacell, a president of Animal Wellness Action and the Center for Humane Economy, said Noem's actions have no rational or plausible explanation. If she's unable to handle an animal, ask a family member or a neighbor to help, Pacell said. If training and socializing the dog doesn't work, then give the dog to a more caring family or to a shelter for adoption. Raising and caring for a dog takes patience and kindness. Tens of millions of Americans who know and love dogs have to wonder about a person who expresses hatred for a young female dog and kills her. Noem has been widely speculated as a possible running mate for Trump, as has U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican from Florida. In other news, a New York appeals court on Thursday overturned Harvey Weinstein's 2020 conviction for rape. The stunning move has prompted questions over what this means for his 2022 rape conviction in California, for which he is currently serving a 16-year sentence. A wave of rape and sexual assault allegations spanning decades against Weinstein began pouring out in 2017, spurring a reckoning in the entertainment industry with the hashtag MeToo movement. The landmark New York sex crimes trial, resulting in the now overturned guilty verdict, signified what felt to many like a turning point. The second trial, this time in L.A., came as the embattled movie mogul, 72, served time in New York. A jury convicted him of rape and sexual assault in the case of Jane Doe 1, who was revealed her identity as Evgenia Chernyshova. Chernyshova is now the only victim of Weinstein to obtain a criminal conviction against him. Weinstein's appealing the L.A. conviction, where he was found guilty of multiple counts of forcible rape, forcible oral copulation, and forcible penetration with a foreign object. Despite the similarities between the two cases, including witnesses who testified in both cases, legal experts don't expect ramifications on the 2022 rape and sexual assault conviction or appeals process, noting that different jurisdictions handle cases differently. At the center of the New York appellate court's majority argument was the judge admitting testimony from woman with allegations that were not a part of the case, known as Molyneux witnesses. Some of the witnesses in the 2020 trial testified during the 22 trial. However, California handles its witnesses differently. Different courts in different jurisdictions often interpret the use of other victims' testimony differently, said Michelle Simpson Tugel, a victims' rights attorney and founder of the Simpson Tugel Law Firm. I think that argument is something that is likely being made in the appellate case in California, but that doesn't mean the same result will be true and it really shouldn't impact it. They are likely doing what we saw with other high-profile defendants, going down every road and trying every angle to get him another bite at the apple and overturn the conviction. A jury in 2022 found Weinstein guilty of the rape and sexual assault of Chernyshova, but the jury hung on several other counts, including accusations involving Jennifer Siebel Newsom, California Governor Gavin Newsom's wife. The jury said it was unable to reach a verdict on her claim and another woman's claim, with Judge Lisa Lynch declaring a mistrial on those counts. Weinstein was sentenced to 16 years after facing up to additional 18 years in prison. Lynch sentenced him to 8 years for forcible rape, 6 years for forcible oral copulation, and 2 years for forcible penetration with a foreign object. She also rejected a motion by his lawyers for a new trial. Weinstein is currently housed at the Mohawk Correctional Facility in Rome, New York. He returned to New York last year after having been extradited to California to face charges there. Weinstein will now likely be transferred back to California to serve the remainder of his sentence for his conviction of rape in 2022. And here is today's Ask Carolyn column with the question, is checking his phone the best way to prove he isn't lying anymore? Dear Carolyn, I found out my partner was lying to me about talking to ex-girlfriends and some other things. He gave me the passcode for his phone in an act of openness, but now has his phone with him all the time. I'm at a loss as to whether I ask him to check it or am I just supposed to trust him going forward because he gave me the code. I also feel yucky checking his phone because it feels invasive, but on the other hand, I want to know if he's still lying to me. What do I do? Signed, Trust Issues. Dear Trust Issues, he lied to you. You don't trust him. Those are the facts. Phone checks have never been and will never be the solution to these problems. Let's say you check his phone every day for the next 10 years and you find nothing. Will you trust him again? When? After month one of finding nothing or year three? Year nine, but only if he's good about remembering your birthday? You are racked with doubt and suspense. That is no kind of life. And again, no amount of phone checking will fix it. Only two things will. One, trusting the people in your life, and two, trusting yourself to handle it if someone breaks that trust. Figure out whether and how you can get to this point with or without this particular known liar and proceed accordingly. Dear Carolyn, my girlfriend and I watch a lot of TV together to wind down from stressful jobs and trying to get ahead in our 20s. It's the only thing we fight about. We belong to the same gym, bike together, and even game together smoothly. With TV, though, she wants to stop me from having fun and being myself. Most shows are stupid, and we all know that, so I like to crack jokes. She hates this and says I'm ruining the shows for her. I can't watch TV and not do this. It's unnatural for me, but she doesn't care. She doesn't see that she's ruining it for me by expecting me to just sit there like a dummy and watch in silence. Other girls I've dated have appreciated it and laughed along with me. I miss that. This isn't something I want to break up over. Is there any compromise here? Signed, Wannabe Me. Dear Wannabe Me, you're doing something she hates, justifying it, pitting her against the other girls, and permission shopping to keep her from being herself. Is this how you treat everyone you care about? And you, quote, can't not do this? Maybe get that checked. Either you zip it, watch TV separately, or compromise. You zip it for her shows and blab through yours. You choose these shows together, you try. You don't get to decide what we all know, then use that to insult her. Hello, by your definition, she watches TV like a dummy. She's entitled to hear dialogue, you're entitled to have opinions, so be respectful and figure it all out. And what's on TV tonight on Fox at 8 p.m., it's MasterChef Junior. The five remaining chefs are tasked with taking the first dish they made on Master Chef Junior and turning it into an elegant and electrifying version. On NBC at 8 p.m., it's The Voice. Coaches Reba McEntire and Chance the Rapper enlist the help of superstar mentors as their remaining artists hold nothing back during the playoffs. Tough decisions are made as each coach can only advance three artists. So You Think You Can Dance on Fox at 9 p.m. In the new episode, Challenge Number 3, Movies, the dancers split into two groups and take on movie-themed challenges choreographed by Jamal Sims and Christopher Scott. And on NBC at 10 p.m., Deal or No Deal Island, power trumps money as the last five players strategically target each other and make crucial moves to advance to the final four. Back to the news in this headline, some schools against arming teachers. Iowa's largest and most diverse school district has no plans to arm its staff, despite passage of a new state law allowing that. Neither do most of the suburban districts surrounding it. Des Moines Public Schools' decision not to utilize the state law is partially because the district already employs a public safety team, officials said. Des Moines Public Schools does not have an interest in allowing teachers and staff to be armed in our school buildings and has no plans to opt into a new program that allows for guns to be present in schools, said Phil Rota, the district spokesperson. Iowa school officials already could arm staff under an Iowa code, but district hit barriers in the process. For instance, the Spirit Lake and Cherokee districts attempted to arm staff under the previous code, but reversed course after their insurance carrier refused to cover the districts if they proceeded. An Iowa poll conducted in late February showed that 60% of Iowans supported arming school staff, including teachers. More than 30 states allow schools to arm staff. And at least four people died, including a four-month-old baby, and scores were injured in Oklahoma this weekend after dozens of twisters swept the U.S. southern plains, while weather alerts on Sunday put more than 7 million Americans under tornado warnings. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt on Sunday declared a disaster emergency for the state, freeing up more money for first responders and recovery operations. Definitely the most damaged since I've been governor, Stitt said in Sulphur, one of the hardest hit communities, on Sunday afternoon, as he provided an update on fatalities and damages. Stitt began his first term as governor in 2019. The Federal Emergency Management Agency had offered the assistance of the federal government, Stitt added. Storm warnings for high winds, heavy rain, and hail also were issued by the National Weather Service on Sunday for more than 47 million people, stretching from East Texas north through Illinois and Wisconsin. The National Weather Service reported 38 possible twisters hit the area and that the worst of the storms rolled through central Oklahoma on Saturday into early Sunday morning. Earlier on Sunday, the Oklahoma Department of Emergency Management reported more than 30 people injured by tornadoes, which destroyed or damaged dozens of homes. The agency said it would not complete damage assessments until storms had fully cleared the area. More than 20,000 customers in Oklahoma were without power as of Sunday afternoon. In this headline, as tourists move in, Italians are squeezed out. And this is from Capri, Italy. Famed for its blue seas, breathtaking views, and cove-studded coastline, the Mediterranean island of Capri has been a tourist haven ever since the early years of the Roman Empire. Unlike in the imperial heyday, when emperors made it their exclusive playground, Capri now attracts visitors from around the world, clogging its narrow alleys, packing the piazzas, and blocking the beaches during the hot summer months. As many as 16,000 tourists a day pour onto the rocky isle in peak season, outnumbering the 12,900 residents. Most are day trippers, but increasing numbers stay the night as ever more homes are given over to holiday lets, bringing its own problems. Capri is becoming a dormitory for tourists, said Teodorico Bonello, head of the local consumers association. There are more people coming than we can cope with, and families can't set down roots because they can't afford to stay. Capri is a microcosm of many European holiday hotspots. Locals depend on visitors for their livelihoods, but the advent of mass tourism risks turning their picture-perfect beauty spots into blobs of shuffling humanity. Some Italian towns and islands are starting to push back, albeit gently. Venice last week became the first city in the world to introduce an entrance fee for visitors in peak periods. Florence has banned new holiday rentals in the city center, and the Cinque Terre Park on the Italian Riviera started charging 15 euros, about $16, for access to a popular coastal footpath to tackle overcrowding. Capri has doubled its own visitors' fee from 2.5 euros to 5 euros, which is approximately $5.35, which outsiders pay when they catch a ferry from nearby Naples or Sorrento from April through to October. "We are looking to persuade more people to visit during winter," Capri Mayor Marino Lembo told Reuters, sitting in his office with the smog of Naples hanging far in the distance. But such a fee looks unlikely to dissuade tourists from traveling to an island which has more than 4 million tagged photos on Instagram, drawing in an endless flow of visitors eager to add the same views to their social media pages. Moreover, locals say it will do nothing to help ease the housing crisis, which forces many essential workers, including teachers and medics, to live on the mainland. Antonio De Chiara, 22, wakes up every morning at 5:20 a.m. in his hometown near Naples in order to be sure to catch the 7 a.m. ferry, which takes 50 minutes to reach Capri. Around 400 other commuters join him on the ride across the bay. Barely out of Naples, those on a tight schedule start lining up in the aisles to ensure they are first off the boat to grab a seat on one of a handful of small buses that head up the hill to town. Stragglers risk a lengthy wait. "It would be lovely to live in Capri, but it is very difficult. Even if I could find a place, the rent would take up all my salary," said Di Chiara, who recently got a job as a child therapist on the island. Stefano Busello, 54, teaches math in a Capri high school but lives in Naples and has commuted back and forth for 20 years. "I have never even tried to find a house here. I could never afford one, and things are getting harder." Italy had near-record overnight stays in 2023, and Italy was the fifth most visited country in the world, with tourists drawn to its quaint village and culture-rich cities, but none were built for mass travel. In the morning during high season, a fleet of ferries disgorge up to 5,000 visitors into Capri's tiny port in just 2 hours. Everyone wants to head up to the town of Capri, but the buses can only carry 30 people at a time, and the funicular 50. "You can easily wait 2 or even 3 hours to get up the hill in summer," said Bonello, flicking through videos on his phone of people crammed one against the other. Lembo acknowledges the problems, but denies tourism is ruining an island his ancestors have lived on for centuries. "I don't agree with nostalgics who say Capri was more beautiful 100 years ago. There was misery and poverty back then. Now there is wealth, and that is thanks to tourism." And how much does that story sound exactly like what is happening on Cape Cod? Some news in brief. Sweltering heat in the Philippines can curb farm production, disrupt water and power, and weigh on businesses, but it also takes a toll on students, hampering the Southeast Asian nation's efforts to catch up to its neighbors in education. Temperatures have hit 122 degrees Fahrenheit in various regions in the Philippines as the weather phenomenon El Niño intensifies the heat, enveloping the nation in its summer months of March to May. The Philippines scores among the lowest in the world in math, science, and reading, partly because of years of inadequate remote learning during the pandemic, according to the Program for International Student Assessment. "It's extremely hot now. The heat burns my skin. It's not like the usual summer heat that's tolerable," said senior high school students whose education were halted during COVID-19. Thousands of schools have suspended classes due to the heat, affecting more than 3.6 million students. Norway's $1.6 trillion sovereign wealth fund, the world's largest, falls short on its climate ambitions by failing to back multiple shareholder proposals, pushing oil companies to cut their greenhouse gas emissions, an NGO report said on Monday. The fund pools the Nordic country's state revenues from oil and gas production. Since 2022, its aim is for the 9,000 companies it invests in globally to reach net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, in line with the Paris Agreement. As part of its strategy, the fund's management, Norges Bank Investment Management, has set expectations for corporate boards on climate change and votes at annual meetings. A report by Norwegian NGO Fremden, shared with Reuters, analyzed the fund's voting record last year on 16 climate resolutions at 9 oil majors. It found the fund supported 7 such resolutions and backed strategy the group said were climate harmful in the remaining 9 of those 16 cases. And a 54-year-old New Jersey grandmother was days or weeks from death earlier this month when she became the 4th person ever to receive an organ from a pig. Lisa Pisano was suffering from heart failure, needed regular dialysis, and had just fallen and broken her foot when she arrived at NYU Langone Health. She had been increasingly sick for years, suffering multiple heart attacks and bypass surgery. She needed both a new heart pump and a new kidney, but because she was on dialysis, she wasn't a good candidate for the heart pump, and because of her heart problem, she wouldn't have qualified for a kidney transplant, said Dr. Robert Montgomery. She was in a catch-22, he said. She was given 2 choices. She could accept her fate and say goodbye to her beloved grandchildren, or take a chance on an artificial heart pump plus a kidney from a gene-edited pig. She opted for that chance. On April 4th, surgeons implanted the heart pump, a device called a left ventricular assist device, or LVAD. She was placed on continuous dialysis and bed rest for 8 days before receiving the pig kidney on April 12th. In addition to showing the viability of the pig kidney, the procedure also shows that LVADs can be used successfully in patients on dialysis. Some maybe will get human transplants because now we've shown that an LVAD can support a kidney transplant. No one really knew that. Pisano volunteered for the surgery to help herself and because if it didn't work for me, it might have worked for somebody else. Her health had started to go downhill in 2017 after her first heart attack and got progressively worse. She had worked in retail, but she had to quit. Her life got smaller and smaller, and in recent months she couldn't even go shopping with her daughter. She said she isn't bothered at all by the idea of having a pig part inside of her. She doesn't eat bacon anymore because of the salt, but she also used to be a fan. Asked if her family members were cracking jokes about it, they better not, she said. Her recovery is slow, but she's not in a lot of pain, she said. She gets daily physical therapy and takes a few steps with walkers. Her main goal is to get back to playing with her 2 grandchildren and cooking for her husband, just living a normal life. And that's all the time I have for today. This is your reader, Beth, saying thank you for listening and thank you for your continued support of the Audible Local Ledger.